You're listening to the Ordinary Vegan Podcast, where we teach you everything you need to know about adopting a plant-based diet, full or part-time. Our goal is to empower you to live a long and healthy life. You can find today's show at ordinaryvegan.net or on iTunes. If you have any questions, please send an email to questions@ordinaryvegan.net.
Hello, friends, and welcome to the Ordinary Vegan Podcast number 21. My name is Nancy Montori, and I advocate a whole foods, plant-based diet for health and wellness. If you're just getting started on a plant-based diet, make sure you listen to podcast number 1, Getting Started on a Plant-Based Diet, and podcast number 10, How to Get Optimum Nutrition on a Plant-Based Diet. I am so excited to have Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn Jr. as our guest today. Dr. Esselstyn is an internationally known surgeon, researcher, and a featured expert in the acclaimed documentary Forks Over Knives. Dr. Esselstyn has single-handedly helped thousands of people recover from heart disease with his New York Times best-selling book called Prevent and Reverse Heart Disease, The Revolutionary, Scientifically Proven, Nutrition-Based Cure, which teaches people how a plant-based diet can treat heart disease. People who have followed Dr. Esselstyn's program, including a number of people who had been told by their cardiologist that they had less than a year to live because of their heart disease, within months of starting Dr. Esselstyn's program, these patients began to improve dramatically, and many years later, they remained free of heart symptoms. Not only that, Dr. Esselstyn won a gold medal in the Olympics, and in 1968, he was awarded the Bronze Star for serving as an Army surgeon in Vietnam. The one thing that never stops amazing me about Dr. Esselstyn is, for all his accolades, he is one of the most approachable, caring, compassionate human beings I have ever encountered. You will know exactly what I'm talking about when you listen to this podcast, so don't miss a minute. Please forgive some of the noise and interruptions. This was live, and that's what happens sometimes. My amazing producer, Doug Barnes, did his best to clean it up. Now, let's welcome Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn Jr. Hello, Dr. Esselstyn.
Hello.
I am so honored and excited to have you on the Ordinary Vegan Podcast. You and Dr. Campbell changed my life because 6 years ago, I had a different career, I had a different lifestyle, but after seeing Forks Over Knives, everything changed. You and Dr. Campbell convinced me about the connection between food and disease, and I wanted to scream it from the rooftops. You don't have to be sick anymore. You just have to change what you eat. So I started my blog, Ordinary Vegan, to help people get healthy. And it ended up being the most fulfilling thing I've ever done. And I really want to thank you for that. So hi, Dr. Esselstyn, and welcome to our health and wellness community.
Yeah, I wanted to say I'm delighted I am to be with your program, and let me know how I can help.
Well, I have lots of questions, but before we dive into all of that, I want to know if you can tell me your origin story. Can you actually take us back to the beginning when you were the chairman of the Breast Cancer Task Force at the Cleveland Clinic? And tell us how that motivated your life studies and about the connection between nutrition and chronic disease.
Yeah, that's where it all started, actually. It was in the late 1970s, early 80s, when I was chairman of our breast cancer task force and head of the section on thyroid and parathyroid surgery, that I became increasingly disillusioned with the fact that for no matter how many women I was doing breast surgery, I was doing absolutely nothing for the next unsuspecting victim. And that led to a bit of really of global research on my part. And it was quite striking to see that there were many other cultures where breast cancer was much less frequently seen. For instance, in Kenya, breast cancer rates were 30 to 40 times less frequent than in the United States. And in rural Japan in the 1950s, breast cancer was very infrequently identified. And yet as soon as the Japanese women would migrate to the United States, by the second and third generation, they now had the same rate of breast cancer as their Caucasian counterparts. And perhaps even more powerful was cancer of the prostate. For example, in the entire nation of Japan in 1958, how many autopsy-proven deaths were there from cancer of the prostate? 18. That's perhaps one of the most mind-boggling public health figures that I've ever encountered. And by 1978, 20 years later, they were up to 137, which still pales in comparison to the 28,000 who perished this year in this country from cancer of the prostate. But nevertheless, it just seemed that there would be more bang for the buck if we could look at the leading killer of women and men in Western civilization, which was cardiovascular disease, because in this global research, there were multiple cultures where cardiovascular disease was virtually non-existent. And this was because those were cultures where they largely were consuming whole food, plant-based nutrition without oil. So that's what got me started. And I then began doing research on patients who were seriously ill with cardiovascular disease, because the dream was this: if we could persuade people to ultimately begin to eat to save themselves from heart disease, they would save themselves from the common Western cancers of breast, prostate, colon, and perhaps pancreatic.
Can you tell us more about your 20-year-plus heart disease study?
Well, the study really was begun initially when with a small group. There are two sections to the study. The first group was really quite small, 24 patients, all of whom were seriously ill with cardiovascular disease. My late brother-in-law used to say these were Essies walking dead. They had failed their first or second bypass. They had failed their first or second angioplasty. They were too sick for these procedures, or they had refused. And five were told by their expert cardiologist that they would not live out the year. Well, the rock upon which my concern was that this study would most likely be to flounder would be the lack of patient compliance. And so, not being a psychologist, I felt that I would try to employ for these patients the same mantra that I had used for my cancer patients, which was something I had learned years ago from a marvelous West Coast surgeon by the name of Bert Dunphy. And Bert used to say that patients with cancer are not afraid to suffer. Patients with cancer are not afraid to die. But patients with cancer are afraid of being abandoned by their family or by their physician. So the first 5 years of the study, I saw these 24 patients every 2 weeks in my office to go over every morsel they ate, to look at their weight, check their cholesterol and their blood pressure. And then after 5 years, I got a little bit more courageous and I was able to stretch it out to every, seems like we got a dog in the background.
That's okay. Makes it more exciting live.
Makes it realistic. So the other thing that we began to see was we began to see striking examples of disease reversal. Not only did everybody begin to stop their disease, but as I say, they began to reverse their disease. And so this made it very exciting and very gratifying to see that indeed with nutrition and nutrition alone that we could halt and reverse this disease. I remember our first patient that we saw reversal on was a gentleman who had difficulty walking across the skyway to my office. He had to stop five times because of pain in his calf muscle because he had a partially blocked artery in his thigh.
And that is from heart disease, huh?
And well, that's from cardiovascular disease. It was the same disease. It wasn't limited only to his heart, for instance. Let me finish the story. At the time, because of his difficulty walking, we did a pulse volume study, which is a study where you check the pulse of the ankle. And this describes a certain strength of his pulse. Then I was so focused on the disease of his heart that I forgot all about his leg until 11 months later. He said, "Dr. Esselstyn, do you recall when I first started seeing you, I had to stop 5 times crossing the skyway to the office?" He said, "You know, the last month it got to be 4 times, then it was 3 times, then it was 2 times, then it was once. Now," he said, "I don't stop anymore. The pain is all gone." So I said, "Don, back you go to the vascular laboratory," and we checked his pulse volume again, and it had now doubled. It had doubled, and this was strictly due to one thing and one thing only. It was rock-solid science that food and food alone had reversed his cardiovascular disease. And what made it so exciting is that I know that there are people who will say, "Well, what about the fact maybe he was taking a statin drug?" This was 1986. We didn't have any statin drug. So even those people who cannot take statin drugs, when they commit fully to whole food, plant-based nutrition, as we described, they can halt and they can arrest their disease.
Wow. So why the disconnect? The CEO of the American Heart Association said diet alone is not going to be the reason that heart attacks are eliminated. And you have called heart disease a paper tiger that need never exist. Why the disconnect, sir?
Well, with all due respect, what we have found that usually when industry leaders are will make that kind of a statement, it's really quite apparent that they themselves have not had an opportunity to avail themselves of how powerful that can be. For example, if we look at 2 years ago, the president of the American College of Cardiology was Kim Williams. And Kim Williams is a marvelous cardiologist from Rush Presbyterian Hospital in Chicago. And Kim Williams himself found that he could drop his own cholesterol and risk factors significantly with whole food, plant-based nutrition. And for a number of years, he has applied this to his patients, fully aware of the research of Dr. Dean Ornish and my own research. As a matter of fact, 2 years ago, I was invited to become a member of the Nutrition Committee of the American College of Cardiology, which I have been proud to do. And right now, as a matter of fact, one of the tasks and challenges before our committee is to have more and more cardiovascular physicians become aware of the power of treating the causation of the illness. Because ever since the days of Hippocrates, there has been a basic covenant of trust between the caregiver and the patient that wherever possible, the caregiver will share with the patient what is the causation of the illness. Now, sadly today, in cardiovascular medicine, that is just not happening. Not because there is any malice of forethought, simply because cardiovascular physicians have never had sufficient nutrition training in medical school, nor in their postgraduate training. And this is very apparent from a survey which we in the Nutrition Committee of the American College of Cardiology have just completed.
It's astounding that physicians aren't using nutrition therapy. Are you seeing that doctors are now using nutrition or teaching themselves about nutrition so they can advise their patients? And why aren't they doing that more?
Well, you know, these things take time. And I have to compare where we are now, where we were 34 years ago when I started. And it is absolutely light years of difference. Sure, we're not there yet. And I mean, we have to get to the point where every physician is aware of the strength of whole food, plant-based nutrition to halt and to reverse cardiovascular disease. This does not mean that every physician should have the techniques, the strategies, and the research to know how to do this. Because just like there is a specialty in radiology, there is a specialty in urology. There's a specialty in neurology. There's got to be a special in especially in lifestyle medicine, because if you are going to have patients make this type of significant lifestyle change, you've got to have the skill set to know how to do this, because quite frankly, this is going to have to change the entire paradigm of how medicine is practiced. For example, I can almost guarantee you that physicians who become familiar with what we're doing and then go back and see their patients in a 12 or 15 minute visit, spending 5 minutes or so on nutrition, and then they're disgruntled because their patient won't follow it, they are absolutely dreaming. This is a profound lifestyle change, and you've got to show the patient respect. The only way that I know to show a patient respect is to give them our time. For example, the reason that in our subsequent study we were running a close to 90% adherence or compliance, I think is because of several things. One, before the patients sign up for our course, they have become familiar either with my book or the website or the movie Forks Over Knives or word of mouth or presentations that perhaps we've given on Facebook or YouTube. So they really have sort of a background. And then when I usually limit our monthly counseling sessions to no more than about 12 patients, and since 85% of them are coming from outside the state of Ohio, I'm not going to be able to see them every week or two. So I've got one shot. And to do this, we do this in a group of about 12, and it takes 5.5 hours. Now, during that 5.5 hours, these patients are going to learn exactly what they have done to create this disease and precisely how they can become the locus of control and be empowered themselves to halt and reverse their disease. In addition, everybody receives a hefty notebook that we give them that has a copy of every PowerPoint slide that I use at the presentation, several of our scientific articles, and also there's a 44-page handout with many additional recipes that add to the 240, which are in the two books that we provide them. Then there's a marvelous hour and a quarter presentation from a wonderful woman who's had 30 years experience acquiring and preparing plant-based foods, dealing with reading ingredients, travel and restaurants. And then everybody receives a DVD of the entire seminar that I filmed from an earlier one, so that should they go home and get forgetful or rusty, they can flip this on and get themselves back up to speed. Then we always have three local or regional participants who've had a previous successful experience share their story with those who are in attendance, so they can then say to themselves, listen, if he or she can do this, I can do this. Then we have an opportunity to answer everybody's questions, a delightful plant-based luncheon, and then we stay in touch as necessary through email or phone call. And I think that this is such a profound experience for them, for an understanding of the mechanism of how they created their disease and how they can be empowered to stop it. There are very few people who would say, God, I love my disease so much, I'm going to keep it going. Nonsense. they're going to change. And I also should share with you that before we ever have our seminar, my secretary will give me 2 weeks beforehand a list of those who are attending with their phone numbers. And I personally insist on calling each of these patients myself so that I can get my arms around their story and at the same time permit them an opportunity to ask questions of me so that when they do come to the seminar, we have a strong platform from which we can all move forward.
Wow, that's great. Do a lot of people, because I know many people are convinced that if they have a family history of heart disease, they are cursed to suffer the same fate. What about hereditary as a factor in heart disease?
Well, I don't think there's any question that if you take 1,000 people and expose them to this horrible Western diet, there are going to be some. They'll get their heart disease in their 30s and 40s. others in their 40s and 50s and 60s, others in their 70s and 80s. So there's no question that there are going to be some that are a little bit more vulnerable. But the nice thing about this is, if we just look at the epidemiology of those nations which never seem to have this disease, all those people who I just mentioned who would be developing heart disease will not develop it, because we can change their entire genetic expression externally with factors such as nothing could be quite as powerful as whole food plant-based nutrition. So, and take those families where all the males have died of heart disease before the age of 55. Well, none of them is going to die if they do not expose themselves to these typical Western diet, which is going to injure them.
That is a powerful statement. So you're saying that a plant-based diet can help everyone who has a history of heart disease or has heart disease?
Let me get into the little bit of the particulars, and we'll see how that works.
Great.
I think all experts would agree that where this disease has its inception, its onset, its beginning, is when we progressively injure the life jacket and the guardian of our blood vessels, which happens to be that delicate innermost lining called the endothelium. And the endothelium manufactures a truly magic molecule of gas, which is nitric oxide, not nitrous oxide, nitric oxide, which has some truly remarkable functions. One, nitric oxide keeps all the cellular elements within our bloodstream flowing smoothly like Teflon rather than Velcro, keeps things from getting sticky. Number two, nitric oxide is the strongest blood vessel dilator in the body. When you climb stairs, the arteries to your heart, the arteries to your legs, they widen, they dilate. That's nitric oxide. Number three, nitric oxide can protect the wall of the artery from becoming thickened, stiff, or inflamed, protects you from high blood pressure, hypertension. Number four, now this is the absolute key. A safe and adequate normal amount of nitric oxide will protect you from ever developing blockages or plaque. So literally, everybody on the planet who has cardiovascular disease, coronary artery disease, carotid disease, have their disease because they have now so sufficiently trashed, injured, and turned their endothelial cell into a train wreck, incapable of making enough nitric oxide to protect them. They then develop plaque or blockages. But the good news here is this. This is not a malignancy. This is a completely benign foodborne illness. And once we show patients what are the foods that every time they pass your lips, you injure and trash the capacity of your endothelial cells to make nitric oxide. Once they get that and get it straight, this disease is reversible. Your endothelial cells begin to recover. They make more nitric oxide, enough to stop the disease, and often we see striking examples of disease reversal. So that really is I've seen patients literally, in the seminar we conduct, I see them almost with tears in their eyes because they suddenly realize that they themselves have been empowered as the locus of control to halt and reverse this disease that is trying to take them out.
Wow, that's very powerful.
But wait a minute, what are the foods that every time they pass your lips, you do injure the endothelium? Do you want me to make a comment on that?
Yes, definitely.
Any oil, olive oil, corn oil, soybean oil, safflower oil, sunflower oil, coconut oil, palm oil, oil on a cracker, oil on a piece of bread, oil on a salad dressing. Oil injures the endothelial cells, as does anything with a mother or a face. Meat, fish, chicken, fowl, turkey, and anything that is dairy, milk, cream, butter, cheese, ice cream, yogurt, and sugary drinks, and lots of sweet dessert, cakes, pies, cookies, stevia, agave, and excesses of maple syrup, molasses, and honey. And I don't like too much coffee with caffeine. Decaf, okay. Tea with caffeine, okay, but not coffee with caffeine.
So while people are somewhat familiar with the effect of animal foods on heart disease...
Let me tell you the foods that we want you to eat then.
Oh, yes. Please tell us the foods we should eat.
All right, I want you to eat all those whole grains for your shoyu, bread, pasta, rolls, and bagels, 101 different types of legumes and beans and lentils, all those marvelous red, yellow, and green leafy vegetables, and sweet potatoes and regular potatoes and fruit. Now, this can result in a tremendous array of absolutely wonderful menus and recipes and a delightful way of eating without injuring yourself. And at the same time, as these patients lose weight, we see their hypertension disappear. We see their diabetes disappear. We see their risk for stroke disappear. The risk for vascular dementia disappear. And a host of other things.
So most people are familiar a little bit with the effect of animal foods on heart disease, but they seem to have a much less understanding of the cancer connection. How would you sum up the effect of animal foods on your potential for getting cancer?
I would have to say that these observational studies are something that really has to get the full attention of the medical profession. I think there's no question. For instance, let's look at this. Let's look at prostate cancer. What did I say as we at the beginning of this program? I said that breast cancer rates were much less frequently identified in those countries that are plant-based, and prostate cancer was barely even seen in the entire nation of Japan in 1958. So really, in those two cancers, it's really quite profound. If you look at cancer of the colon, Dennis Burkitt, who was a marvelous physician and researcher, in all the years that he was in Africa, he saw one case of cancer of the colon, and that was in another missionary who obviously had spent a lot of time eating the Western food in London. So there is really been, I think, a very strong epidemiologic relationship how cancer can be perhaps prevented in those nations which are largely thriving on whole food plant-based nutrition. And it was quite profound to see in October of 2015, the entire World Health Organization was in agreement as classifying red meat and its carcinogenicity almost equivalent to the same risk of smoking, especially when it came to prepared meats and smoked meats and bacon and the like. So, you know, we're getting there, but obviously the animal food industry would be feel very threatened, just like the dairy industry, and they have enormous amounts of money, and they will buy into science. And they'll do what the cigarette companies did for the longest time. They'll deny the existence, and they'll try to denigrate the research. But the facts are there, and hopefully, in time, we'll be able to set the record straight.
Okay, so you mentioned oils earlier, and I get so much pushback because I don't promote oils, and many people think avocado oil and olive oil are heart healthy. So can you please tell us why vegetable oils are bad, and are they just bad for heart patients or for the general public?
Let's start with the public. It's interesting that when we carefully looked at the coronary arteries of our young GIs who sadly died in combat in Korea, we found that 80% of those young men at average age 20 already had gross evidence of coronary artery disease that you could see without a microscope. Not enough for their cardiovascular event yet, But there it was with the disease already on its way. And that study was repeated 45 years later in 1999 in the Journal of the American Medical Association. This time they were looking at young women and men who had died of accidents, homicides, and suicides between the ages of 17 and 34. And guess what? Now the disease is ubiquitous. Nobody seemed to be escaping. Not enough, again, for their cardiac events yet. But here we go back to what I was mentioning earlier about the causation of this illness by injuring your endothelial capacity to make nitric oxide. We start in this country injuring our blood vessels as infants and children. Think of all those Western foods we're eating. All the meat, all the dairy, all the oils, and much and sugar. And as those multiple hits occur, by the time we're 12 years old, if sadly somebody gets run over or killed, you can see already the early fatty streaking. Now, give it 6 or 8 years later, in their late teenage years, boy, there it is. The plaque have already started. Not enough to have your cardiac events yet. But you keep injuring and injuring and injuring these interior of the vessel. Now when you're in your 40s and 50s and 60s, now we start actually seeing these cardiac events of heart attack and stroke and so forth. So that's the sort of the when you talk about the general public, I think you can make an argument that and in America, really everybody themselves has this foundation of heart disease. So why is it that oils are a sort of a tragic part of this? If you go over the research of heart disease, you'll find that in the 19th century, sure, it was seen. A lot of people were eating meat, right? A lot of people were eating dairy. But probably one of the most famous physicians of the 19th century, early 20th, was Sir William Osler. And Osler, in a description in 1997, had seen only two patients with angina pectoris, or heart disease, angina. By 2010, when he wrote it up again, he had now seen 205 patients. But it was interesting, right at 2010, that was when, of all places, Procter & Gamble in Cincinnati had made an alliance with a German family by the name of Kaiser, and they took the cottonseed oil, and lo and behold, they began to make cooking oil after hydrogenating it, which is one of the worst things you can do for heart disease. And lo and behold, now we have the epidemic really begin to take off. The thing that we have to understand is science really came into the picture about these oils in about the last 20 years. And let's just give you a little bit of background to and your listeners so they'll understand why I have this hesitation and why a number of us has severe hesitations about oil, especially for our patients who have heart disease. You recall that a few minutes ago, I made the point that we're all experts who agree on the inception and the origin, the beginning of heart disease is when we progressively injure the capacity of the endothelial cell to make nitric oxide. Now, how do we measure nitric oxide in a patient? First, you take an ultrasound probe and you'll place it over the brachial artery at the elbow, and there, with an ultrasound probe reading, you'll get a readout and you'll get a certain diameter. Then, for 5 minutes, you encircle the upper arm with a blood pressure cuff that you inflate above systolic blood pressure so that now for 5 minutes, you have absolutely zero blood flow to your forearm and hand. Then you release the cuff and immediately take the ultrasound probe and measure the new diameter of the brachial artery at the elbow. And now, in the normal patient, this will be 30% greater because of all the outpouring of nitric oxide in response to the time when you had that upper arm tourniquet applied. Now, what has been done that was elegant I'll give you an example. Robert Vogel, who was the chairman of cardiology at the University of Maryland, took a group of healthy young subjects to a certain fast food restaurant. Half of them got cornflakes, and then they had the brachial artery tonic test done, and it was normal. The other half had the hash browns and sausage. And 120 minutes after they'd eaten that meal, they had the brachial artery tourniquet test done. They couldn't dilate the artery. That single meal of hash browns and sausage had so trashed, so injured, so compromised the capacity of their endothelial cells to make nitric oxide, they simply didn't have enough to dilate their vessel. Now, they're being young, as they followed them into the late afternoon and early evening, they began to recover. But you can just imagine hammering and injuring and pounding that tender, gentle endothelial cells all of your life. You can imagine how the amount of nitric oxide becomes less and less and less. So what we found now is that when you take oils and do the same thing, have somebody eat olive oil, do the brachial artery tourniquet test, the capacity of the endothelial cell to make nitric oxide is diminished. And so the oils really have a role in destroying the capacity of the endothelial cell to make nitric oxide, and they therefore hasten along in the process of joining dairy and meat and sugar to injure the endothelial production of nitric oxide. I hope that answers your question.
Yes, I totally understand it, and I hope everyone out there does too. How about nuts and avocado for heart patients? I have read that you don't advocate nuts and avocado for heart patients.
Well, I guess you could call me a little bit as an outlier on this, and I'm not going to be apologetic because right now, our patients who are compliant will compete with anybody's program anywhere on the planet, and we'll actually hold our own or do better. Well, let's talk about nuts. Now, there are some elegant studies that clearly show that saturated fat can injure, all right? Saturated fat can injure blood vessels. We also know that back when I first started these studies back in 1985, it was really interesting that when researchers and scientists wanted to experimentally develop coronary artery disease or atherosclerosis, cardiovascular disease in a rodent or in a rabbit, they would use peanut oil. So that truly kind of raised my antenna, and I just didn't want my patients to possibly be exposed to that. Now, how many people do you know who will eat one nut?
Not many.
I don't have a problem. I don't want almost anybody to hear me say this, but I suppose that if I had somebody say they could have a half of one or two or three walnuts, it'd probably be okay, but that's not what people would hear. They would say, oh, I heard Dr. Esselstyn said that nuts are okay. If I ever say that, they'll be in the glove compartment. They'll be in the bathroom. They'll be in the kitchen, the bedroom, the hallway, the workbench. They're highly addicting. And what are you going to be getting with all that? You're going to be getting, if it's peanuts, you're going to get peanut oil, which is going to harm endothelial cells. You're going to get all that saturated fat. Now, it's interesting. That would really, I think, help me turn this around. Has there ever been a study where you take patients who are seriously ill with cardiovascular disease and give them nuts and cashew butter and nut butter and peanuts and show that you can halt and arrest and reverse disease? I have not seen that, but I have seen studies where there have been in diets with containing nuts where the disease is developed. Created. So I'm a little bit suspect about nuts, and I'm going to look, if let's say that I'm proven wrong in another five or 10 years, I will have never have hurt my patients by not allowing them to have nuts. And right now, we kind of think it's a winner.
I understand.
You had another question about avocado. That avocado, see, so many of my patients don't have to gain weight, and avocados are so loaded with fat, some of which certainly is saturated. Yeah.
I also get a lot of questions about starchy carbs, and plant-based physician Dr. McDougall says humans are starchivores. So do you agree with that? Should we eat a lot of starchy carbs, and do starchy carbs make us gain weight?
Well, first of all, you won't get me to criticize John, because John's a good friend, and I think he's been a pioneer in this area for a long time. John essentially uses what we use. We all seem to, who are into this movement, we're all using whole food plant-based nutrition. Many of us choose to call it whole food plant-based nutrition. John happens to call it starch.
What has changed since you filmed the movie Forks Over Knives? And is there any information that was provided in the movie that doesn't hold up today, or anything new that has been discovered since making that movie?
I think the producers and directors of Forks Over Knives did an excellent job in being able to get the attention of the public. I think fascinating for some people to hear former President Clinton describe his appearance on CNA. That helped resonate and stimulated a number of people to have an interest in nutrition and cardiovascular disease. What I think is really on the horizon for us that has developed since Forks Over Knives, although it certainly was hinted at in that film, is that the reason I guess some of us are so passionate today, perhaps even more so than even in the days when I used to do surgery, that the medical profession has at its fingertips something that is really going to be able to put the entire planet on the cusp of really what could be a seismic revolution in health. And by that I mean the seismic revolution in health is never going to come about from another pill or drug. It's never going to come about through a procedure or an operation. But the seismic revolution in health will come about when we in the profession have the will and the grit and the determination to share with the public what is the lifestyle, and most specifically, what is the nutritional literacy that will empower them as a locus of control to absolutely destroy chronic illness. And by that I mean what we have seen with patients who consume whole food, plant-based nutrition is we have seen literally, as I mentioned, heart disease, you can actually halt and reverse, the same with strokes, the same with diabetes, the same with hypertension and vascular dementia. Also with Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, we've seen it with rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, and the multiple sclerosis, allergies, asthma, and kidney disease. In other words, it's as almost as if the heavens have opened and presented the medical profession with perhaps the most powerful tool we have ever had in our toolbox. It is not going to cost the patients anything because you got to eat. And it has no horrible side effects. And there's no Pharmageddon. There's no reliance on all these expensive pills with their side effects. And it's really quite exciting because here is a way that we as a profession can show patients how they can eliminate chronic illness. Because right now, almost all people who are in their 40s and 50s and they're merrily, happily going along, still getting along with this Western diet, little do they realize that in the next 10 or 20 years, they are going to be the victim of some horrible chronic illness. and that horrible chronic illness does not have to occur.
The last question I wanted to ask you before I ask some questions from my community is that, what do you think of this new fasting trend, limiting calories for 5 days a month? I think it's called the fast mimicking diet. It was mentioned a couple of times on the Holistic Holiday at Sea from some plant-based doctors, and I just wanted to get your opinion.
Well, like everything else in medicine, you know, it has to be subjected to peer-reviewed research. In other words, it can't be done by simply writing a book or treating a small number of patients. But I think there is evidence that there are absolutely going to be the benefits for some people from fasting. But I think that still has to be additionally researched. But nevertheless, in the setting where fasting is done by supervision from physicians and healthcare workers who recognize what are the physiologic occurrences as somebody fasts, I think that is something that I think is probably definitely has a place to be studied, and where patients can go for help. It's been shown to be quite profoundly wonderful in terms of diabetes and getting patients to get their hypertension under control as well. So that's something I think I really keep my eyes and ears open, because I think there could be a place for it. But to specifically say that it ought to be on 5 days, I don't know that is definitely superior, or how to the groups that might come in and fast for 10 days or 2 weeks straight. I just think there has to be more data on something like that.
Thank you. Do you have time just for me to read some questions for you from the ordinary vegan community?
I'll do the best I can.
Okay. This question is from Madeline. Dr. Esselstyn, I once read that you stressed that the health of blood vessels is dependent upon what you are eating, in spite of the numbers. So if I'm really eating 100% plant-based, all whole grain, beans, fruits, and legumes, why would I still have high cholesterol numbers and still need to take a statin medication? Or do I need to still take a statin medication?
Well, this is going to be a little difficult perhaps to grasp, but there were some comments by, I think, people who have been very carefully aware of this, who have said that in persons who throughout their lives carry a cholesterol naturally of 150 or under, are unlikely to ever develop cardiovascular disease. But I think that may have happened even in the large, well-known Framingham heart study out of Boston in a few special situations. But generally, it's correct. On the other hand, here's what we have to look at. Of all those people who have cholesterols over 200, excuse me, let's say between 200 and 150, in the Framingham study, 30% of those who developed heart disease has cholesterols between 150 and 200 total. And yet, look, there are thousands of those patients who carry the cholesterol in the over 150 area, between 150 and 200, and over 200 who never developed cardiovascular disease. Now, how does this all square? Well, my own feeling is that you have to go back to the science. And the science tells us the following, that even though we know that oil will injure your endothelial cells, if you happen to be eating oil and you're in the island of, let's say, Crete 70 years ago, and you have oil, but at the same time, in Crete, you are eating a lot of vegetables and a lot of fruit and a lot of what we call polyphenolic compounds. And polyphenolic compounds are antioxidants which can protect against the injury that is being caused by olive oil. So I'm going to try to make this all make sense in a moment. So if you have somebody who, even though they happen to be eating the Western diet, let's suppose they don't eat much meat and they don't eat much dairy, but they eat a lot of vegetables and they have a lot of fruits, and they're eating a diet which is heavy in natural antioxidants and polyphenolic compounds. Now what you have is this. We all have a thermostat in our liver that everybody is going to make a certain amount of cholesterol. That is essential. We need cholesterol. Cholesterol is a vital membrane of every single one of the cells in our body. All the basis for our sex hormones, the basis of vitamin D. So cholesterol is essential. Now, everybody's liver has this thermostat to make cholesterol that is different. For instance, if I go on a fully whole food plant-based diet, really strictly, my total cholesterol may bounce between 101 and 112. But when I'm eating the Western diet, before I ever started all this, it was 190. And yet other people who are very close to me, who have gone on this program through the last 30 years with me, will never get a cholesterol between 200, below a 200 or 190. But they'll never have heart disease. Why? Because they are not ever injuring their endothelial fortress. So the lining of their artery will not develop a fissure, a crypt, a weakness, an opening through which cholesterol can penetrate and then begin starting this nasty journey of oxidative inflammation, which leads to plaque formation. So if you still have somebody who's absolutely eating purely, not cheating at all, and their cholesterol may be 200 or 210, and they're eating lots of polyphenolic foods, vegetables and fruits that are loaded with natural antioxidants, they should be fine.
So they don't need a statin medication if they are on a 100% plant-based diet?
I'd want to see exactly what they're eating, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but look, we have had many patients in our program who were absolutely crippled by trying to take a statin. Either it made them diabetic, it injured their liver, it gave them brain fog, or it gave them such severe neuromuscular pain they couldn't take it. They were in no way precluded from enjoying the benefits of whole food plant-based nutrition and the capacity to halt and reverse their disease. Because I mentioned several times, I think, we've had a couple of patients, both of whom I've written up, who never, one of whom refused statins, the other who was cured his disease before statins were even invented. And it was really quite exciting to see how powerful the correct food itself can be. Yeah.
Thank you. This question was asked by many community members. Dr. Esselstyn, what do you think of plant-based meats to help get my family over the hump?
I'm lost. Tell me what a plant-based meat is.
Like a Beyond Meat or Gardein or, you know, meats that are faux meats that are made with pea proteins and soy and processed.
Well, let's go back to the beginning. When you are eating out of a box, a bag, or a can, you're eating highly processed food. I have never known studies where patients who were seriously ill with cardiovascular disease were given these products and their disease reversed. When I ask patients to eat whole food, plant-based nutrition, sure, there are going to be some crackers that are made without oil, some bread made without oil. That's okay. But really, I don't want them, ideally, to have to eat out of a box, a bag, or a can. If you go to the produce aisle in a store, there's a potato, there's a pepper, bok choy, Swiss chard, kale, collards. None of those things have ingredients on them. You know what you're getting. There's not a label or a list. Because once you start processing food, that's when we get into trouble.
This is from Annie. I love tofu, but I'm very confused about soy, and I believe you advocate limiting soybeans. I also read that soy contains estrogen mimickers. Is tofu healthy, and how about edamame?
I think that there's a lot of love for certain soy products. I confess at least 3 or 4 times a month we may have some tofu. Remember, though, that soy is genetically modified, and 40% of soy is fat. And my friend Colin Campbell has pretty much shown me that, and if you have an excess of protein, it tends to elevate the IGF-1, insulin growth factor 1, which tends to be a tumor promoter. So I'm a little cautious about soy.
This is a very specific question. It's from Angela. She said she's been vegetarian for 26 years and recently went vegan. She has an autoimmune disease called scleroderma, and she also has high cholesterol and was placed on a statin. She was wondering, will a vegan diet improve the atherosclerosis, or is the hardening of the arteries due to the scleroderma? Both her parents had heart attacks.
Well, I don't ever use in my book the V words vegetarian or vegan. I talk about whole food plant-based nutrition. I treat vegans for heart disease. Why? Because vegans will eat oil. Vegans will eat french fries. Vegans will eat glazed donuts. In other words, so if somebody wants to be whole food plant-based nutrition and they are willing to completely eliminate all the oils, anything with a mother or a face, meat, fish, chicken, fowl, turkey, and dairy, and sugary things, then I think they should be okay. As far as the scleroderma is concerned, I don't have a great deal of experience with that, but it certainly is not going to be harmed by going with whole food plant-based nutrition, and let's see if it won't do the same for that. I mentioned a number of other diseases, but I didn't mention scleroderma because I have not had any personal experience with that.
Marjorie wanted you to know your book, Prevent and Reverse Heart Disease, convinced her to change her diet. She had amazing results in reversing her serious health issues, and she's telling everybody to read it because you won't regret it. Well, thank you so much for giving us an hour of your time. I am so grateful. I was wondering if there was any question that most people don't ask you and that you wish they would to end this.
Well, I can't believe that I've ever thought that I would say this, but one of the questions that most people who are naive about this will say is, where do you get your protein? Well, how many people do you know who are eating whole food plant-based nutrition and have gone to the emergency room and said, my God, help me out. I'm short on protein. That'll never happen. Listen, all the grains are loaded with protein. All the beans are loaded with protein. Vegetables are loaded with protein. It's almost impossible to be protein deficient eating a full variety of whole food plant-based nutrition. And I should mention, increasingly we are seeing professional athletes migrating towards whole food plant-based nutrition. Why? Because they have greater stamina and their recovery time is shortened. As a matter of fact, the strongest human being on the planet, Babudian from Germany, is wholly plant-based.
Now, I'm just going to ask you one personal question, if you don't mind. So what did you eat today?
Well, I'll have to have my wife tell you what our soup was. It was just so delicious, I didn't bother to look.
Oh,
I know there was some
great cook, right?
Potatoes in it, but
it was a red lentil cook, and the first soup in our cook in the Prevent and Reverse Heart Disease cookbook. It's fabulous.
The red lentil soup.
Red lentil dill.
All right, the
with
red
mix.
Lentil.
Yum.
She cut up some delicious potatoes that went into it. Yeah.
Well,
but breakfast, I usually, and I had today, I had raspberries, blueberries, strawberries, and blackberries, all four. And I pour that over oats, often with banana, okra, banana, and then I also use some oat milk, but I do not cook the grain. I like to have the grain be a...
Skype.
As it comes out of the box. It's almost like a dry cereal, because once the oats have the oat milk on them and those fruits, I mean, it'll steal the eye right out of your head. It's so delicious.
Yum. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Esselstyn.
A pleasure.
You are a hero to so many, and for good reason. And you can buy Dr. Esselstyn's amazing book, Prevent and Reverse Heart Disease, on Amazon, and I'll provide a link in this week's show notes.
I'm with you.
And Dr. Esselstyn, you have an event coming up on your family farm in New York on August 18th called Plant Stock, correct?
That's right.
Well, I attended a previous event on your farm years ago, and it was insightful, inspiring, amazing lectures, and full of delicious food. So I highly recommend it. And the bonus to the weekend is you get to meet Dr. Esselstyn's wife, Anne, and daughter, Jane. That's it. Thank you again, Dr. Esselstyn. It has been such an honor, and I hope to see you on the next Holistic Holiday at Sea.
Thanks, Nancy. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. All I can say is, wow. If he can't convince you of the connection between coronary disease and diet and cancer and diet, no one can. Thanks so much for joining me today. I hope you leave this broadcast with knowledge you can take with you and share with others. I will put links to Dr. Esselstyn's book and upcoming event at his farm in New York in our show notes this week. And if you get a moment, please write a review on iTunes. The more reviews on iTunes, the better chance of being seen and ranked by iTunes. Thanks for all your emails and feedback. I appreciate it so much. Don't miss our next podcast, where I explore everything you need to know about the new trend of fast-mimicking diets. Till next time.
Thanks for joining our plant-based community today. Together, we can accomplish great things. Please subscribe so you don't miss any of Ordinary Vegan's recipes and plant-based tips. If you have any questions or feedback, email us at questions@ordinaryvegan.net. Until next time.